the headlines, Tehran says political divisions within the U.S. are preventing Washington from making political decisions. The Vienna talks, adding that should not result in a violation of Iran's rights. Iran unveils a new long-range ballistic missile capable of hitting targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers. And Omicron spreading fast across Russia, where a new record daily high has been registered. Hello and welcome, everybody. Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, says political divisions within the U.S. ruling establishment prevent Washington from making political decisions needed to advance the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna. In a Twitter post, Shamkhani said the U.S. government cannot make up for its domestic crises by violating the rights of the Iranian people. A few days ago, the U.S. granted a series of sanctions waivers to Iran, but now some Republican lawmakers are expressing outrage at Washington over that decision. In a classified testimony before Congress of U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, Republican lawmakers have called for a public hearing. They said the Biden administration has not been transparent about the process of its conduct regarding the JCPOA. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the accord in 2018. And now Tehran is calling for guarantees against any violations in the future. Our Vienna correspondent, Omar Lizgi, says the political divisions regarding the JCPOA revival are not limited to the U.S. government and can even be traced within the country's negotiating team in the Austrian capital.
The eighth round has resumed. Yesterday we had a meeting between the heads of delegations of Iran and the European sides, and also the EU, basically EU coordinator Enrique Mora. Also there was a meeting after that later in the evening between the Iranians separately with the Russians and the Chinese. Today we're expecting more talks to be held. They haven't started just yet, but they are expected to be held later in the afternoon. Now, also yesterday, the Russian ambassador, Mr. Ulyanov, after his meeting with the Iranians, had a separate meeting with the U.S. Special Representative Robert Malley, and said that in that meeting he'd discuss the prospects of the Vienna talks. And of course, this looking back at what's been happening in the U.S., what the Iranians and sources of the negotiations have been saying all along is that this is why they want the guarantees. The fact that there is division clearly in America right now, when the Biden administration is making decisions here, there are Republican lawmakers back home who are saying they are going to, clearly saying they're going to hamper implementation of a possible agreement. They are going to try and foil it. They are asking for Congress reviews and revisions, etc., etc., etc. So the Biden administration is under pressure there from the Republican side, facing a lot of opposition there. We even saw aspects of that division here in Vienna when two members of the Rob Malley team withdrew and they were replaced. One of them, Mr. Nephew, known as the architect of sanctions against Iran back in 2015. And all those seen as signs of division, not just between Democrats and Republicans, but also in the negotiating team itself here in Vienna.
Iran's southwestern city of Ahvaz has hosted an exhibition showcasing the latest domestically produced petroleum equipment. The event comes as Iran is trying to indigenize its oil sector in the wake of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali reports on that.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahvaz is hosting one of the major oil shows in the country. The Ahvaz Oil Exhibition brought together 210 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are in the list of U.S. sanctions.
One of our major products is the two-phase flow pump, which is a vital piece in the oil exploration process. We used to be dependent on foreign supply of this equipment, and due to the sanctions, it was really hard to access it. So we decided to rely on our domestic expertise, and we now build two-phase pumps locally. We also specialize in the production and execution of all kinds of offshore oil rigs from A to Z.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But Washington's oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build this needed machinery, including drilling bits. And the result is beyond expectation.
Because of the sanctions, the oil industrial companies could not, you know, import these very important drilling rigs. So in these years, we made more than 300 drilling bits and PDC bits, and we made it, you know, we manufactured it domestically. And we think that we can continue, you know, manufacturing all of the needs of Iran.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal and the reimposition of sanctions the same year. Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power. Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts here say this would be another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the blows of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Ahvaz.
Well, Iran has unveiled a new long-range ballistic missile to mark the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The missile, dubbed Khaybar Shikan, is able to hit targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint accuracy. It also can penetrate into missile shields with high maneuverability. The projectile is classified in the third generation of long-range missiles developed by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in recent years. Iran has made great advances in its missile program, which it says is entirely defensive. And the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says Iran's foes cannot easily attack the country. In an interview with Iran's Al Alam TV, Hassan Nasr said it's not in the U.S. interest to attack Iran, as it cannot stop Tehran's peaceful nuclear activities. Nasr said he believes Israel's repeated threats in recent months to attack Iran's nuclear sites are all empty words, and the regime won't make the mistake of launching a war on Iran. Nasr said Tel Aviv knows that if it strikes Iran, the response will be harsh, decisive, and precise. He said some Arab states that normalized ties with Israel can't help the regime militarily. Nasr also touched on recent diplomatic contacts between Israel and some Arab states. He said Israel's plan to normalize ties with the Arab world is doomed to failure, since people in the region oppose it.
In Bahrain, they will not be supportive of it. Even inside Saudi Arabia, the Saudi society are not with normalization of ties, even those who go on televisions. This is Egypt, this is Jordan, this is Northern Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia, Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, all the Arab and Islamic world.
Nasser said the regime's normalization efforts are mainly aimed at pushing Palestinians to a state of despair so they accept defeat and give up on their cause to liberate their lands. He said Palestinians will resist such plots as they're brave and steadfast on U.S. sanctions on Hezbollah. Nasr said such measures won't have a major impact on the resistance movement. He said the U.S. sanctions war cannot stop Hezbollah's growth and development. Nasr also referred to Yemen's recent retaliatory strikes against UAE. He said Abu Dhabi had to plead for help from Western countries following the attacks. Nasr said such attacks will continue until the UAE and Saudi Arabia stop their aggression against the people of Yemen. Mariam Saleh joined us earlier with more on the Hezbollah Secretary General's remarks.
Of course, he mentioned the fact that the United States is building a huge embassy in Lebanon, a new embassy, different from the one it is in right now, and that the U.S. has always been, before 1982, before the attacks, the original attacks on the former embassy in Beirut, and the fact that there was so much protest and opposition against the U.S. Dictates in Lebanon and control over Lebanon and interference in Lebanon, it besides the fact that the U.S., the main CIA center, the main center of intelligence for the United States is based in Beirut. And this embassy that they are building is going to be a center not only to control Lebanon, it's going to be for the entire region. All this normalization is only a normalization between two countries that are actually countries made out of glass, as he mentioned, especially the United Arab Emirates, that this is a state made out of glass. They cannot protect themselves from a confrontation with Ansar al-Nahda that is just recently retaliating of the presence or the participation of the United Arab Emirates in the aggression against Yemen, and they could not handle that. They pleaded for the entire world to help out after Ansar al-Nahda and the Yemeni army decided that they would retaliate targets within, deep in the heart of the UAE. So therefore, how could they help protect the Israelis if they could not protect themselves? Of course, he spoke generally about the region, about the problems that are in Lebanon, the U.S. sanctions in Lebanon. He also, of course, mentioned the fact that the United States is trying to revive Daesh, trying to revive that Takfiri Wahhabi group in order for it to either give pretext to its presence in the eastern Euphrates to continue its theft of the natural resources of Syria, but also to continue that that control that they have over Syria, and to try once more, perhaps, to take down the government of Syria, which is a part and parcel of the resistance alliance.
Israel's ambassador to Britain has been met with protests by university students after she was invited to speak at Cambridge University's debate union. Though her talk in Cambridge went ahead, so did protests outside the venue. Robert Carter was on the scene.
Students and activists gathered outside England's Cambridge University on Tuesday to voice their anger after Israel's ambassador to Britain, Tzipi Hotovely, was invited to debate at the prestigious Cambridge Union Debate Hall.
So, once again, the ambassador finds a significant protest following her outside the university venue where she is speaking. It's not the first time, and it probably won't be the last. These protesters have made absolutely clear that they consider her to be a racist and a fascist.
Despite the police presence, activists made noise, lit flares, and eventually blocked the car park entrance, disrupting the ambassador's ability to leave. Protesters told Press TV why they were so furious.
To be Jewish is not to be blindly nationalistic. Israel doesn't represent Jews. Just like I don't represent all Jews, I represent myself, and I represent some Jews.
This is the Israeli ambassador to the UK, and they didn't choose someone who was a moderate. They chose someone who is a representation of the Israeli state at the moment, a fascist apartheid state, as testified to by Amnesty International. Someone who believes in the ethnic superiority of one race over the other, which Hotovely does believe, and the sustenance of that through ethnic cleansing and settlements, because she was formerly settlements minister, is something that we should all be demonstrating against.
Back in November 2021, Hotovely was similarly met with protests after speaking at an event at the London School of Economics. Home Secretary Priti Patel was among several pro-Israel MPs who rushed to condemn the incident, despite police saying it was not under investigation. As she left Cambridge, again she was booed and jeered, leaving some wondering if she'll again try to accuse students of anti-Semitism, despite the fact Jews, as well as Muslims and Christians, were among the demonstrators' ranks. Robert Carter, Cambridge.
Russia's logging a record number of daily coronavirus infections as Omicron continues to spread like wildfire in the country. Authorities have detected over 183,000 new cases within a span of 24 hours. They've also reported approximately 700 fatalities, faced with the biggest virus surge yet. Russian authorities have resisted imposing any major restrictions. The vaccine rollout is slow. Only about half the population has been fully immunized so far. The total number of coronavirus cases since the beginning of the pandemic has now surpassed 13 million. When NATO announces plans to ensure a larger permanent presence of its forces in Eastern Europe, critics say the move is designed to further provoke Russia. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have traveled to the United States, Ukraine, and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount, and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe, and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Congratulate all our listeners worldwide on the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
Tens of accomplishments have been made in different parts of the Islamic Republic, some of which I have mentioned in the statement of the second step of the revolution. We must speak about these great achievements of the Islamic Republic and remind the people and those who forget these things. So this is another point that needs to be considered. Another point is the issue of being among the people. Well, thankfully, the government that is in office today has good relations with the people. It shows its presence among the people. Its popular movement is tangible, but this must be completed. First of all, it must continue. Now, some individuals are questioning this course of action, but they should be ignored. It is very tiring to constantly be present among the people, even for government officials. It is hard work and it is not easy. But it is very effective. It is very good, and it must continue. Secondly, they must fulfill the promises that have been made to the people. These promises must be fulfilled in the allotted time so that people will know that this is serious.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
It may not be possible to fulfill a promise. There are cases when a promise is made, but in practice, the background has not been prepared for it to be put into practice. In such cases, they must go to those people to whom this promise was made and explain things clearly. They should state the reasons why they could not fulfill that promise and say that they will do their best to fulfill it at a later time, inshallah. This is another point which is about fulfilling the promises that have been made to the people. Another point is that sometimes experts and specialists who are from among the people suggest ideas and solutions to the officials for different sectors. Officials should come up with a mechanism in order to be able to benefit better from these ideas. And this will actually help people to participate in the decisions of the responsible organizations of the country. This is one point. In addition, in order to benefit from the capabilities that are available in the people in practice, they should come up with another mechanism so that they can help the people participate in action as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel announced on July 22nd that it had been granted an observer status in the influential African Union after unsuccessful lobbying for nearly 20 years. Since the disbandment of the Organization of African Unity in 2002, Israel had made futile attempts to join the African Union, which replaced the OAU. However, the move was always thwarted by members of the Union, who even called for an end to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories in February. The crisis was set in motion last July when Moussa Faki Mahamat, chair of the African Union Commission, accepted Israel's accreditation to the 55-member body headquartered in Addis Ababa, triggering a rare dispute within a body that values consensus. Powerful AU member states, notably South Africa and Algeria, quickly spoke out in protest, saying they had not been properly consulted and that the move contradicted numerous AU statements showing their support for the Palestinian territories.
The reason that there are such fierce divisions with regards to the matter of Israel and the African Union, Israel having observer status, is the manner in which Israel became secured its observer status. The decision was taken unilaterally by the African Union head instead of through the consensus procedures that the African Union is accustomed to. In other words, it was forced on the African Union.
In contradiction to his decision just 2 months before accepting Israel's accreditation, Faki himself condemned Israeli bombardments in the Gaza Strip, as well as violent attacks by Israeli security forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds, saying the Israeli army was acting in stark violation of international law. But now Faki has defended his decision, claiming that it could be an instrument in the service of peace. However, Palestinian resistance movements hit back, with Hamas calling on all freedom-loving Africans to voice solidarity with the Palestinian nation and compel Faki to revoke the decision. Hamas said in a statement that reads, "The occupying regime has long practiced state terrorism and systematically commits all kinds of crimes against the Palestinian people, their territories and holy sites. It enacts a policy of ethnic cleansing and racial discrimination as documented by many international human rights organizations." So, how could granting membership or even an observer status to Israel serve as an instrument in the service of peace? While the African Union's main goals are rejecting racism, demanding decolonization, and the right to self-determination, experts say Israel's observer status is largely seen as part of Tel Aviv's continued campaign to normalize ties in Africa.
When countries expand their ties with Israel, they usually do so in order to get access to Congress or in Washington or the White House. And African countries have been seeking, of course, lobbying access to the Congress and the White House, and believe that ties with Israel helps them.
Back in August, the Algerian foreign minister, Ramtane Lamamra, condemned the decision to grant Israel an observer status at the bloc as a huge mistake. He also chastised the chairman of the AU Commission for defending his decision, saying insistence on the measure will eventually result in the breakup of the regional organization. But what is Tel Aviv after? Israel's AU observer status would pave the way for normalization with African states. In recent years, it has successfully done this with Chad, Sudan, and Morocco, but it's also viewed as an attempt to influence the continent on diplomatic issues. Also, Israel couldn't have normalized ties with these countries without Washington's help. The U.S. used economic or other types of incentives to broker normalization deals between African countries and Israel. For instance, on the same day Sudan signed the U.S.-sponsored deal to normalize ties with Israel, Washington signed a memorandum of understanding with Khartoum to clear $1 billion of the country's arrears to the World Bank. Also as part of the normalization deal between Morocco and Israel, the U.S. recognized Rabat's sovereignty over Western Sahara, a disputed region claimed by both Morocco and the Algeria-backed Polisario Front.
So the reality here is that there is a recognition that the Palestinian people are continuing to suffer, but political interests, narrow political interests, perhaps naive and very crude political interests, have given rise to this very awkward dilemma for the African Union that threatens, in the words of the Algerian foreign minister, to rip apart the African Union if a solution cannot be found to this, the solution being, of course, removing the observer status from Israel.
Israel violates international law as well as international humanitarian law and refuses to implement dozens of resolutions or to abide by recommendations put forward by relevant United Nations committees. Lately, international rights groups have accused the Tel Aviv regime of imposing apartheid on Palestinians. This is while Washington provides the regime with around $3 billion in lethal aid every year. It also invariably uses its veto power at the United Nations to block the world body's anti-Israeli resolutions. So, doesn't joining the African Union only prepare the ground for Tel Aviv to spread its evil further? The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has provided some sanctions relief to the countries that had nuclear cooperation with Iran under the terms of the 2015 multilateral agreement. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Friday signed several sanctions waivers related to the 2015 Iran deal, also known as the JCPOA. The waiver covered the conversion of Iran's Arak heavy water reactor, the provision of enriched uranium for its Tehran research reactor, and the transfer of a spent and a scrap reactor fuel abroad. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. The waivers are part of the 2015 accord. They were canceled by former U.S. President Donald Trump after he withdrew from the agreement in 2018 and reimposed anti-Iran sanctions. The latest U.S. move reverses the Trump administration's decision and lifts the sanctions threat against foreign countries and companies from Russia, China, and Europe that had been cooperating with Iran under the terms of the JCPOA. The media cited a U.S. State Department report as saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks on the revival of the agreement. Meanwhile, the waiver announcement prompted hawks in Washington to accuse the Biden administration of giving concessions without securing any commitments from Iran. Senator Bob Menendez has asked that the president adopt a tougher position on Iran. He called for new efforts, including creative diplomatic initiatives, stricter sanctions enforcement, and determination from Congress to support President Biden's declaration that Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, something that Iran has repeatedly denied seeking. In addition, these waivers will not entail financial relief to Iran, though there remains a strong case for upfront humanitarian relief as it is the people of Iran who have suffered the most under U.S. sanctions. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume talks in Vienna. Iran says an agreement hinges on the removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't pull out of the deal again. Iran says there have been positive developments in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna, but they do not fulfill Tehran's expectations. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian says the 2015 nuclear deal hasn't had any economic benefits for Iran in recent years. Amir Abdullahian says Tehran is firmly and explicitly seeking a good deal that would guarantee Iran's economic benefits reliably and sustainably.
I think it is a symbolic pitch. So I think the Joe Biden administration can do better than that, and by starting to lift all the sanctions on the frozen huge amount of money. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars frozen in foreign banks that belong to Iran, and that will be a positive step, not a symbolic step.
A day after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden restored a sanctions waiver, which was rescinded by his predecessor Donald Trump in May 2020, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show goodwill on the ground, not on paper. He also said, "We demanded the guarantee at all political, legal, and economic levels. Agreements have been reached in some areas, but the Iranian negotiating team will seriously pursue getting tangible guarantees from the Western sides that they will abide by their commitments under a Vienna deal." That's in reaction to recent comments by U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, who said Washington cannot guarantee the next administration's adherence to the JCPOA. Iran has time and again stated that one of its main issues is to get the necessary guarantees from the other parties, especially from the West in the Vienna talks.
Well, there is no guarantee for Iran that even Joe Biden, after the signature of this deal that is going to be signed or will be signed and soon, perhaps in the next couple of months, is going to be respected. There are no guarantee that the U.S. is going to respect the deal, and certainly no guarantee that the next administration will abide by it.
Also, Iran's top security official Ali Shamkhani says real, effective, and verifiable economic benefits for Iran are a necessary condition to reach an agreement in Vienna. He said making a pretense of lifting sanctions is not considered to be constructive. He added that Iran has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities. His comments came as Iran is now awaiting a political decision by the U.S. and European countries for a breakthrough in the sanctions revival talks in Vienna.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a U.S. ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there, Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. You know, in Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters. That, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, the short answer to this, is it's called misdirection, or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate the pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded. China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions, dubbed the Cold War, that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale.
Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The list of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there. What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encouraged the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kadhim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام: علم الله لا يوصف منه بأين، ولا يوصف العلم من الله بكيف، ولا يفرد العلم من الله، ولا يبان الله منه، وليس بين الله وبين علمه حد.
إمام الكاظم عليه السلام stated: The knowledge of Allah cannot be defined by where, nor can Allah's knowledge be described by how. Allah's knowledge cannot be separated from Him, nor can Allah be distinguished from it. And there is no barrier between Allah and His knowledge.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the different dialogues of the blessed infallible imams, of course we cannot overlook the dialogues of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. And so it's interesting, in one of these conversations we find that the historians have narrated that this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, entered the masjid of the Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, the Masjidun Nabawi, which is of course in the holy city of Medina. And Imam al-Kadhim saw some people surrounding a certain man, and they were magnifying him and glorifying him, and they were exaggerating in the essence of honoring this individual. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam said to one of his companions, "What is that man?" The companion replied, "He is a alama, a great esteemed scholar." Imam al-Kadhim said, "In what science is he an alama?" And then the companion said, "He is the most knowledgeable in the lineage and the battles of the Arabs." Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam then turned to his companion and explained to them that beneficial knowledge is of three kinds. He says, a clear verse, or a just religious duty, or a standing sunnah. And then he said that other than these three knowledges, everything else is a surplus. Genealogy or having knowledge of events of a war do not grow intellect, and nor does it grow spirituality. When Imam al-Kadhim talks about a clear verse, of course he is talking about ayatun muhkama, a clear verse, which is the Holy Quran. A just religious duty, of course, is our religious obligations and the things that we must refrain from, that Islam tells us to. And finally, akhlaq, a standing sunnah. And these are the things which are the true knowledge of humanity, and they bring about the growth of intellect, the growth of spirituality, and the growth and progress and development of human society. These are the words and the dialogues of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When it comes to this individual and his relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he would recite in sujood, and how beautifully when we commemorate the shahada of the seventh imam from the ship of salvation of the Ahl al-Bayt, we recall these wonderful statements that truly help an individual seek proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Do you know what the imam would say? إِلَهِ عَظُمَ الذَّنْبُ مِنْ عَبْدِكِ فَلْيَحْسُنِ الْعَفْرِ. O Allah, the servant that has come before you, his sins are indeed too many to recall. Yet I know you are the most generous, and you are the most compassionate, and you are the one who is oft forgiving. And here was the Imam alayhi salam, known as Al-Abd al-Salih, Shaykh al-Mufid says, كان أفقه أهل زمانه. He was the most knowledgeable of his of the people of his time. Another title that the Imam salamullahi alayhi was known and continues to be referred to is Babul Hawa'ij, the gate by which the hajat and the needs of the human beings are fulfilled by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
The case of a crisis.
Thank you very much for waiting.
At the end of 2013, efforts to find the political solution to resolve the crisis in Syria escalated. Lakhdar Brahimi, the UN Secretary General's special envoy, was able to convince Bashar Assad to negotiate with the opposition. The Syrian government, in light of victories achieved with the help of Iran and Hezbollah, was in a better situation than the past and would be able to take part in peace talks with a stronger stance.
Syria is now undoubtedly the most serious crisis
even though Lakhdar Brahimi announced that the Syrian government and the opposition would hold talks in Geneva, serious problems existed in the path of the success of the talks. The most important problem was, who was going to be representing the opposition to negotiate with the Syrian government? The National Syrian Council, which was known as the political opposition, didn't have much control over the battlefield and couldn't decide for extremist Salafi groups.
Do the Syrian opposition who go to Geneva represent the opposition? Which opposition are you talking about? Daesh and Nusra, the same fighters among the opposition, were not at these peace conferences. Nor were they invited, nor did they have a ceasefire. And they had little ceasefires with Nusra, but that's different. I think the official opposition, as we in the West regard them, as opposed to the Assad official opposition, I don't know if they represent many people anymore.
The next problem was that the US and Western countries still insisted on their position that Assad has to step aside, and this position was not acceptable to the Syrian government and its supporters.
We believe that President Assad has lost the legitimacy necessary to be able to be a cohesive force that could bring people together.
At the time, Iran, as one of the influential sides on the political spectrum in Syria, expressed the desire to be present in the process of resolving the political crisis.
Iran will attend the Geneva II talks if invited. We believe that Iran's presence in those talks are useful, will contribute to a resolution.
The United Nations also welcomed the initiative.
That Iran would play a positive and constructive role in Montreux. Therefore, as convener and host of the conference, I have decided to issue an invitation to Iran to participate.
But the invitation was faced with the opposition's reaction.
Iran has not satisfied the minimum requirement for this invitation, and we thank the Secretary General for accepting the letter that was sent by the head of the National Coalition, Mr. Ahmed Al-Jarba, in this regard.
The U.S. government put pressure on the U.N. to withdraw the invitation, and in the end, the pressures were successful.
The Secretary General is deeply disappointed by Iranian public statements today that are not at all consistent with that stated commitment. He continues to urge Iran to join the global consensus behind the Geneva communique. He has decided that the one-day Montreux gathering will proceed without Iran's participation.
In January 2014, talks between the Syrian government and opposition forces took place in the city of Geneva, with international players in attendance. And, as it was anticipated, the participants only insisted on the conditions they had in mind.
That means that Bashar Assad will not be part of that transition government. There is no way possible in the imagination that the man who has led the brutal response to his own people could regain the legitimacy to govern. One man and those who have supported him can no longer hold an entire nation and a region hostage.
The inconclusive Geneva II meeting showed the Syrian conflict was not ready to be resolved with a political solution. At the time, the two sides of the conflict were almost balanced, and both still had hopes of victory. That's why one side of the war had to first substantially improve its position on the battlefields to be able to force the other side to accept its conditions to end the conflict. Because of this, even though Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey had disagreements over the Muslim Brotherhood, they agreed that they would unite the extremist Salafi groups affiliated with them. At the beginning of 2014, the Islamic Front was officially formed with the coalition of a number of leading armed groups in Syria. Since each of these groups was active in a different part of Syria, the Islamic Front covered almost all of the country, and these groups did not engage in parallel conflicts. On the other side, the Iranians also felt that with the existing